Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. And if you are listening to today's interview and would like to be featured on the network, please visit speakuptalkradio.com for all of the details or contact us at pr@speakuptalkradio.com. Right now, I have an author with me who has written a book for our times, a story about the timeless struggle between mothers and their teen daughters with social media as the backdrop. She is Herta B. Feely. Herta is the author of numerous short stories and memoir published in literary journals and anthologies. She received two fellowships for a novel in progress, the James Jones First Novel Fellowship and an Artist in Literature from the D.C. Commission on the Arts and Humanities, and an American Independent Writing Prize in Personal Essay. She is the co-editor and publisher of an anthology of 22 authors' short stories and memoir titled Confessions, Fact or Fiction, in which she explores the blurred line between the true stories and fictional ones. She organized readings for the anthology in bookstores in Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and St. Louis. Now an editor, writing coach, and ghostwriter at Chrysalis Editorial, a company she founded, Herta has worked with hundreds of writers helping them to perfect their writing and find agents and publishers for their work. She has ghostwritten two memoirs, both of which have been published, and she also reviews books occasionally for the Washington Independent Review of Books. Herta was born in Yugoslavia, when there was such a place, grew up in southern Germany, then St. Louis, and finally, California. She received a degree in Latin American history at UC Berkeley and has also completed her studies at the university's graduate journalism program. And from Johns Hopkins University, she received a Master of Arts in Writing. She has worked for a variety of causes ranging from human rights violations to alternative energy to childhood injury prevention. And in 1988, she co-founded the National Safe Kids Campaign, which is now called Safe Kids Worldwide, with pediatric trauma surgeon Martin Eichelberger. And she lives in Washington, D.C. with her husband, where she reads, writes, and tends to her cats and many orchids. And I'm just thrilled to learn more and share her with you. So welcome to the show, Herta.
Thank you so much, Pat. It's a pleasure to be here.
What a fascinating background, and I'm kind of intrigued by cats and orchids. How does that work out?
Well, you know, ever since I was a little girl, I picked up stray cats, and I've just had a succession of them and seem to not be able to live without them. So right now I have two cats, Monty and Albert, and I don't know, I was drawn to orchids some years ago, so I have a whole window full, a south-facing window, and, you know, they kind of come and go too, though.
And the cats don't bother them?
No. Although my cats are very freewheeling. They, you know, they'll go and sit on the, wherever there's a sunny spot, mm-hmm. even if it's on the kitchen table.
No, I get that. You're my kind of friend because I've rescued, right now I have 11 cats that I've rescued. I know. People always ask, oh, are you going on vacation? Are you going here and there? I can't leave. Sorry, I've got 11 people to take care of.
Well, maybe we should trade places sometime. You can come take care of mine. I'll take care of yours.
Oh, my gosh. I love each and every one of them, too.
Yeah.
Very, very special.
Very cool.
Yep. Well, now we'll get to your books. Maybe give us a mini tour of your writing journey and the books that you've written thus far.
Okay. So I wrote my first novel, and that took a period of about 10 years. I was raising my two sons. I had quit work. I had quit Safe Kids and decided I wanted to be with my two boys as they grew up. And so in the mornings when they left for school, I would come and sit at the typewriter and oh my gosh, how old am I? sit at the computer and work on this novel, which was semi-autobiographical, and for which I received those two fellowships that you mentioned. And I worked on that while I was getting my Master of Writing from Johns Hopkins. And one day I was at Bread Loaf, which is, a lot of people know what that is. It's a writer's community workshop that lasts for about 10 days up in Vermont. And I was so proud of that thing, especially because I'd received those two fellowships, and I showed it to an editor from Norton, W.W. Norton, and she just, it was, the first chapter was published in a magazine called Provincetown Arts Magazine, I think it is, and so I, you know, turned to the page where my first chapter is, and she kind of glanced down at it and for like 10 seconds, and she said, "I can't stand first person present tense."
Oh no.
Gulp. I was oh my gosh, I thought, oh, she's so mean. And then she said, "I would just put that on the shelf and write your next book." So after my, you know, I got over my wounded ego and my pride, I thought about it. And I thought, well, how much do I really like this book? You know, is this book really worthy of being published? And I finally decided, you know, I don't think it is. I think it was the book with which I learned to write fiction. And now it's time to move on. And so I started to write short stories and started sending them off, and they started to get published. And I started to develop greater confidence in my writing abilities, my fiction writing abilities. And at the same time, I had started Chrysalis Editorial, so I was doing work with some other clients. And then one day I saw an article, this was in 2008, in the Washington Post, about a young teen girl who was cyberbullied and then committed suicide. That girl's name was Megan Meyer, and the cyberbullying was led by a 16-year-old boy named Josh Evans. And he and Megan had been flirting on MySpace for a while. MySpace was kind of the precursor to Facebook. In the course of that cyberbullying, he suggested that Megan kill herself, and sadly, she did. And as I read that article, what was really horrifying was the fact that Josh really wasn't Josh. He was a 47-year-old woman who was a neighbor of Megan's. And so essentially, you know, that woman was behind Megan killing herself. She was a mother, and her daughter had been friends with Megan. I think they had a falling out. And this mom wanted to see what Megan was saying about her daughter. It was so shocking to me that someone would do this, that almost right away I had the idea that I needed to write a novel to understand how a woman could do such a thing to a child. The other thing that was really intriguing to me was this whole issue of social media. Mm-hmm. Because at the time, in 2008, believe it or not, all you listeners, did not use Facebook, I didn't use Twitter. I knew about them, but really, you know, not that much. And so that sort of drew me to the story as well. You know, the impact that social media can have on a person. It's about a 7-year journey from the time that I thought of the idea to the time that I wrote it to the time that I got an agent and publishers both in the U.S. and the U.K. Mm-hmm. So I feel very, very fortunate that that happened. I think part of the appeal of the story is its timeliness. There's a lot of cyberbullying out there. Social media is constantly in the news, as you well know. We have a president who engages in constant tweeting. That's kind of how the book came about. And in terms of, I guess, my writing trajectory, that sort of answers that question, too.
I'm just in awe that you were inspired by that story to do something about it. So often you hear and you read these things that, you know, they do impact you,
right?
But you don't take that second step to actually do something about it. So you need to be congratulated for taking that story and really creating something that other folks can read and learn from. So the name of that book is Saving Phoebe Murrow. Give us a little synopsis of that.
So while I was Megan Meyer inspired me. This story is not a recreation of that story. Saving Phoebe Murrow is a completely separate story, but it is about a girl who gets cyberbullied And that happens right in the first chapter. She's also a girl. She's 13. She's just starting high school. She's going to a school here in Washington, D.C. Her mother is a high-powered lawyer who's juggling work and family. And she does know that her daughter cuts. She self-harms in the form of cutting when she feels emotionally overwhelmed. So that's another aspect of the story. The story very much deals with mother-daughter relationships. It deals with friendships and loyalty and betrayal. My character, Phoebe, has a best friend, Jessie, and another one named Emma. They are very stalwart friends, and they've seen her through a lot. She has a kind of nemesis named Skyla, who she is hoping will not be at this same school. She's not supposed to be coming to the same school. But, of course, then she does end up there. Phoebe also is interested in boys and has her eye on a guy. So there is, in this story, we have five different people's points of view in the story. The main one is Phoebe's mother, Isabel, who's the lawyer. Another one is her friend Jessie's mom, Sandy, who is a stay-at-home mom. Ron is Phoebe's father. He's a journalist, and his point of view is also part of the story. And finally, in a very, sort of short segment, there's a boy named Noah who Phoebe liked. And we know at the very beginning of the story that Phoebe might harm herself because of the cyberbullying that's happened. But after chapter one, we roll back 2 months to the beginning of the school year, and we see what happened that brought us to this point. So the book is divided into three sections, and eventually we find out, whether Phoebe tried to commit suicide or not, and then all of the ramifications of sort of the aftermath of the cyberbullying incident.
Now, you chose to use cutting as a way for her to inflict harm, and nothing like that went on when we were in school. And I have a daughter who is a marriage and family therapist, and she said, "Mom, you wouldn't believe the number of families that I work with where this is a problem." So why did you choose that?
You know what? I think that there are certain things in the universe that they're just out there. And that we as human beings, whether we're writers or whatever, field we're in, suddenly we channel that. Because honestly, I didn't even know anybody who cut. Mm-hmm. But suddenly that was the thing that came into my mind, that this girl cuts. And I wrote those scenes where she's cutting and where she's finding relief from her emotions when she cuts. And I contacted a researcher at Cornell University who is at the sort of forefront of working on and researching self-harm, self-injury, cutting, and I had asked her to read some of those sections, some of those scenes, to see if they were realistic. And the thing that surprised me the most was she said, yes, they're very realistic. And honestly, I hadn't done any research. I did my research later. And there's also an article, I started to look up online because I have my character, Isabel, looking online about cutting. Mm-hmm. So I ended up communicating with Dr. Edward Selby, who's mentioned in the story. So anyway, that is, I do want to say that the researcher told me that cutting sort of replaced anorexia and bulimia, which were the main ways in which girls were self-harming, before the mid-90s. And in the mid-90s, it was Angelina Jolie, mm-hmm. who apparently admitted to cutting. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, she said, it's like a cultural thing that we hear about it and then we imitate it. Because I remember, before that, I remember hearing so many mothers tell me of their girls who were suffering from anorexia or bulimia. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it's all about cutting. So it's a very interesting phenomenon.
Absolutely. As you're saying that, I'm realizing as well, you don't hear about anorexia or bulimia anymore. Very interesting how kind of becomes this weird fad. As we're talking about this, I'm wondering, are these risks and challenges, whether it's self-harm and cutting and the dangers of social media, do you find that as dramatic for teenage boys?
You know, the funny thing is there are actually more boys who are cyberbullied than girls, but for some reason we seem to talk about it more in relationship to girls. I mean, as I have myself, and I don't know why that is.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think we're in this space? How did we get here?
It all started with the internet. We are a global community, whether we want to be or not. We've got something called the World Wide Web, WWW, right? And it links us all. I mean, now, at the drop of a hat, what do? We, quote, Google something. We look something up on the internet. And that is how social media got its start. And you know, social media can have a very positive effect. If there are parents who are listening, I would suggest to them a couple of things that they really need to educate themselves about social media. What are the social media apps that their children might be using? There is an organization here in Washington, based in Washington, but it's on the internet, and it's called the Family Online Safety Institute. And I'll repeat that, Family Online Safety Institute. It's AFOSI.org. And they have tons of information about, quote-unquote, good digital parenting. And that is, unfortunately, parents now have that additional responsibility. And I know from my Safe Kids days how difficult it is to be a parent and to just provide the basics for your child. So now we have to add one more thing to the list. Mm-hmm. And also, if your child is cyberbullied, or if you know of someone who's being cyberbullied, there are steps that need to be taken and that ought to be taken. And one of the places where you can find help is the Megan Meyer Foundation. So the girl that I was mentioning earlier who was in the article who committed suicide, her mother, in the wake of her daughter's death, Tina Meyer, created the Megan Meyer Foundation, which is entirely dedicated to ending bullying, cyberbullying, and suicide among teens. And Tina is amazing. She goes around the country speaking. They have all kinds of information on their website to help people. So, you know, we got here because of technology, and we will continue to have to deal with, you know, the fallout of that, because I think a lot of times technology and so on is a step ahead of us, and we're just, you know, we're working to catch up. Mm-hmm. So now we're recognizing, wow, okay, social media has its positives, but it also has these negative potential, which we need to figure out how to deal with. And a problem isn't a problem until we recognize that it is a problem, mm-hmm. and then we can take the steps to alleviate that problem, right?
Yes, thank you for that. Thank you for giving us some advice, because I was going to ask you what kind of advice you had for parents who were concerned about the negative effects of social media. And you're right, this just kind of crept up on us as the web became available. There's so many advantages to it, and parents are pulled in so many directions that it's hard to take a look at everything that your child is doing. And so it's very complex, and there's a lot of layers to it as well. And there should be a way to get your book into the hands of every junior high student.
Some of my fans, which is so nice to have, they have said things like, every parent needs to read this novel, because I think it opens your eyes to what's there and what the potential is. And also, I think it starts a conversation. I've been part of a number of book groups that have read my novel, which, by the way, I'm very open to, because we can do these things long distance, thanks to technology. I can Skype into a book group. But people have said they've either told me their own stories of their children or themselves who have been bullied. And the people who are older, who didn't grow up with social media, they said, you know what? I am so glad there was no social media back when I was being bullied, because at least at the end of the school day, I could leave. Mm-hmm. I could go home, and I could get away from my bully.
Yeah.
But with cyberbullying, it's 24/7, and you can't get away from it, which is why I think it has so much more devastating of an impact, and why so many people have actually killed themselves as a result. And when I say that, you know, I don't mean to over-dramatize it, but certainly it is creating a lot of anxiety among children. And I think that they need our help in dealing with it.
Yes, I agree that it doesn't necessarily have to end in death, but just
exactly.
It's a slow death for a child to have to live every day of their life going through this. I've just discovered JOMO, the joy of missing out. And maybe that's something we can help our kids with, that you don't need to be tethered to this. And there are other things that we could be doing throughout the day. So let's put down these devices and get out and take a walk and enjoy nature and spend some time with people that actually love you and make sense. So
exactly. So, I love that. That's fantastic.
Yep.
We need to take time to reflect and to have downtime.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't have written a novel if all I was doing was social media all day long, which, you know, there are plenty of teenagers who spend hours and hours on social media each day.
Mm-hmm. This is obviously a topic we could spend the whole day talking about. Yes, but I think it's been very important that we bring this up. Let's head back to your book. Talk a little bit about the cover art. You have the butterfly on the cover, and your company is called Chrysalis Editing. And so I'm sensing there's a butterfly connection here.
Yes. You know what is really amazing about that cover? This cover was designed by the art director at 27 Books, which is an imprint of Bonnier Zaffra in the UK. And before I saw any book covers, I spoke to a friend of mine and I said, I have this thing about butterflies. I love them. And I said, oh my God, you know, I would love to have a butterfly on the cover of my novel. And she said, oh, well, I don't think that's going to happen because there are no butterflies in your book. And I said, you're right. And I never ever said anything to any of the people at Bonnier about butterflies and my love of butterflies. And when they sent me six potential book covers and they wanted my input, which was very nice, I opened up the document and three out of the six had the butterfly on it. We both liked this one that is the cover, which has sort of that sliced Phoebe. The letters of the word Phoebe are sliced in half,
yes.
Which, of course, is a reference to the cutting.
Cutting, yes.
And I think the butterfly, and I thought, wow, you know, how did that happen? Again, you know, the universe at work, but I do think that Phoebe is very fragile in a way, and also, you know, it's a symbol of transformation. So I believe that's, for me anyway, that's what that meant. So I don't know. What do you think?
I got that, especially when I saw that your company was Chrysalis Editorial and just the whole transformation idea. Then I put that together, and I loved that slice in her name as well.
Yeah.
I just thought it's a perfect cover.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who did it is just fantastic.
Wow. Wow. How fun is that when you open that up and you saw the artwork?
Oh, I was like, oh my God, my dream come true. So, you know, so dreams can come true, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. It was meant to be. Share a bit about your company, Chrysalis Editorial. There are a lot of writers that listen, and maybe there's some ways you can help them.
Sure. I worked for an agent for about a three-month period back in, I think it was, 2006. And my job was to go through all the stuff that came in over the transom, you know, the unsolicited manuscripts and so on. And I had this second story little office, and I felt like Rapunzel trying to spin gold out of hay. There were just so many manuscripts. Well, out of the hundreds that we got, I picked three and gave them to the agent saying, okay, these three I think have potential. Of the three, she was able to sell one of them. But in the process, I realized that I'm a really good editor and that I can really pick out what's wrong with a story, what's not working. And also, of course, you have to understand and affirm for the author what is working. So in realizing that, a year later, I decided to sort of hang out my shingle with Chrysalis Editorial, and I put an ad in Poets and Writers magazine that I'm an editor and I'm available for manuscript critiques, for writing coaching, and ghostwriting. And, you know, it was amazing how many clients I got just from that one little ad and having a website. And so, you know, I started to work with people on various projects, a lot of fiction, a lot of memoir, and that it's a very satisfying sort of work for me. So when I'm not doing my own writing, I'm usually working on somebody else's manuscript.
Right.
And I love giving people encouragement and hope. I also give people advice about publishing, because there are lots of options these days. You know, traditional publishing is one route. Partnership publishing is another, and self-publishing is the third. Mm-hmm. And certainly Amazon made that last one a real possibility.
Right, right. And I'm happy they did. There's a lot of good work and good people out there, and it's a great opportunity to be able to hear from more people other than just a select few. So
it is a great, I don't even know if this is a word, but democratizer.
Yes.
That's the word I'm using.
I agree. Share the website, the Chrysalis Editorial website.
www.chrysalis.editorial.com. And Chrysalis, you know, you can look it up if you don't know how to spell it. And I realized later that that's sort of a difficult word for people to spell. But in any case, I think you'll be able to find it. And I also have an author website, which is simply www.hertafeely.com.
Excellent. Two places that we could find you. Before we end, I would like to just have you share a bit about, you are co-founder of the National Safe Kids Campaign, which we say is now called Safe Kids Worldwide. That had to have been exciting work. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes. And, you know, that came about because I was working on a documentary and I was promoting that documentary. It was called Our Children's War. It was going to be airing in 5 major cities. And I was working with the doctor who's featured in the film, Dr. Martin Eichelberger. He's a pediatric trauma surgeon. It was then that I learned that children's accidents, unintentional accidents like car crashes, pedestrian, you know, drownings, fires, that sort of thing, is the leading killer of children. And it all comes under the umbrella of injuries, unintentional injuries. And as I started to work with him, I realized that there was no coordinated national effort to address this problem. And I thought, well, there should be. And when I told Marty Eichelberger, he said, oh, he said, absolutely. He said, yeah, do it. And so I did. So I started to, you know, research, and we ended up getting a big corporate sponsor through Johnson & Johnson. It was a very good fit. And we started focusing, you know, sort of harnessing the energy around this issue by coordinating all different kinds of organizations that touch on that topic, you know, whether it's the American Red Cross or the National Safety Council or the American Academy of Pediatrics, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, and so on. And we formulated a kind of, I think, very unique method of dealing with the issue, bringing it down to the local level and then taking it back up through the state level and up to the national level. And it's education, it's public policy, it's you know, taking action and organizing people around the issue, teaching parents what the issues are, because again, until we know this is the leading killer of kids, we're not taking the steps to prevent that from happening.
Well, it's all about awareness, and you certainly brought that awareness to people. You have had quite a colorful life, haven't you?
Well, you don't even know the half of it.
I'm sure. Well, with that in mind, what's next?
So I'm working on a novel right now, tentatively titled Her Other Life. It's about a human rights activist, and we're sort of shining the spotlight on human rights violations in the Middle East and artifact destruction in the Middle East with the Syrian war and Afghanistan and Iraq. But really, it's a love story, and it's about this woman who fell in love with a Nigerian sculptor at Oxford, earlier in her life, and they come back and find each other again.
And when is this due?
It's due now. But in terms of when it's going to come out, I imagine it would be either later this year or early next year.
Okay. All right. Sounds like it's a child. And when is this due?
You know, it's funny. With Saving Phoebe Murrow, it took me 9 months to write.
Oh, there you go. I love it. I love it. All right. Well, we've covered quite a bit, but is there anything that we missed that you would like to talk about today?
No, I'm just so grateful to people who have listened to this and people who purchased Saving Phoebe Murrow. And if they do and they have something that they would like to share with me, I love to hear from my readers. And finally, for anyone who does read books and loves them, we as writers are so grateful when you post something on Amazon or Goodreads or wherever. Mm-hmm. It's very, very helpful to the writer. So thank you, everyone, for all of that.
Oh, that was awesome. Thank you. So there's two websites we can send folks to: your personal author website, which is Hertafeely. It's Hertafeely, Hertafeely.com. And your Chrysalis editorial, and I won't even spell that. Just you should know how to spell that, people. ChrysalisEditorial.com. Again, Herta, thank you so much for sharing you and the work that you've done in your lifetime. Very, very important. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much, Pat. It's been a pleasure.